we didn't sit around and focus on like the guys that hit it long, right? Like Chris Kirk was kind of one of the best players. Webb Simpson was one of the best players in my generation. I was a good player. Kiz was a good player. I'm probably missing a bunch. And we weren't that long. It wasn't that big of a deal.
This is The Tournament Code.
Thank you for joining us, Roberto. It was fun meeting you over at Golf House. Appreciate you coming out to that event and fun connecting. And now getting to talk with you for the podcast is going to be fun. I want to quickly note to our audience, as a reminder, this episode is going to drop on Friday the 18th. I think that is the coming Friday. And so the thing to note is you're going to notice for 2 weeks we won't have episodes. That's because as a reminder of this season, Friday's the 17th. As a reminder, this season, every episode that drops is dropping the first 3 weeks of the month. And then the last Friday or the second last Friday, we aren't dropping here, but we will drop something on our Supercast, ttc.supercast.com. That's where we put our episodes so that we can pay the bills, keep the lights on, all that fun stuff. Now that we're through that though, Roberto, let's do the Putview Books. Our awesome sponsor has the Putview Books opening tee shot, which is where we ask you a trivia question, kind of as an icebreaker, kind of gets us rolling here. So I don't know where you feel. I'm going to give you an option as to where you feel the strongest with kind of Jeopardy categories. We can either go with golfing legends category, or we can go with Masters tournament category for the question.
Potent potables is not an option.
No, unfortunately not.
Golf legends.
All right. This one's a little distinct, but we'll see. Which golfing legend started out playing as a child and junior using only a 3-iron and a putter?
Seve.
Okay. Very good. Perfect. That's a guy who knows his golfing legends. Very nice. Well, that was a perfect tee shot there. Let's kind of get into what you're up to now. We're going to talk about your golf career, but I kind of want to talk about what you're up to now and how you got there from your golf career, and then we'll jump into golf.
All right. Start at the now and then go back. Sure. So I played on tour from 2012 to 2021. I played my last event, but the last couple of years I was kind of figuring out what I was going to do next. Players got so good, so fast, so young that I saw my my stock declining. So dusted off my education, and I was helping different golf businesses on the consulting side. So whether it was brand or business strategy. And then I started working for CapTech, was one of my clients. So CapTech is a consulting firm, technology focused, mostly Fortune 500 clients, but has a big and growing sports practice. So they were my client. I liked them. They liked me. We had, you know, a lot of opportunity, a lot going on. So I work full time now for CapTech. So I focus on our sports practice. We do work for PGA of America, the new TGL, the Tiger Rory deal. We work for NASCAR, a bunch of others. So it's a lot of fun, a huge blessing to be able to combine kind of my educational background and then all my years in the sports industry. So my full-time gig is CapTech. Also have a podcast on the business side of golf called Course Record Show. We dig into, again, this is more about playing and competitive golf. We're always looking at the business side of things. So check that out if you get a chance.
Excellent. One thing that you mentioned was, you know, you realized that your stock was declining, that it was hard to play on tour because everyone was getting so good. What was the genesis for that in your mind as far as noticing that in your game and deciding, okay, well, go play. There's plenty of other places to win in life than the golf course. Is deciding to go win somewhere other than the golf course.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I don't know, 6-8 years into my time on tour, maybe seven, I went to work with Rotella and I was just completely burned out. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. Classic burnout. So we spent a couple of days in Charlottesville and came out of it like completely re-energized, right? And his whole thing is like play to play great. Like, that's all you're doing is play to play great, have a ball. That's his favorite line, I think. So I basically like re-engineered all my thinking, all my practice, all my prep towards winning tournaments. Like That's it. That's all I cared about. And over the next 12 months, I really had like three or four good chances to win. And I think Mississippi probably could have won. Putts didn't fall my way. And then at Quail, I lost in a playoff to James Hahn. And then fast forward to the BMW, I needed to finish like in the top two or three to make it to Eastlake. And I played as well as I can play. So played unbelievable for 4 days, made putts on Thursday, made putts on Friday, made putts on Sunday. Saturday, I didn't really make anything and shot like one over at Crooked Stick. But I mean, really, that's as well as I can play for 4 days. And I lost by seven shots to Dustin Johnson. So I played with him Saturday. Sunday, I think I played with JB Holmes, Kentuckian, I think. But point being, I walked off the green and was like, that's as good as I can play. And I didn't win. And it was very rewarding, and I felt great about it. And playing, you know, getting to Eastlake and getting back in the Masters was, I mean, it was a huge celebration, you know, reasons to celebrate. But it really made me realize that, you know, if your best golf isn't winning, and that's one of the best fields in the world, right? Opposite fields and, you know, lower level tour event. Like, I do think I didn't have to beat Dustin Johnson to win an event or win a tournament. There are other ways to win without winning one of the 5-10 best tournaments of the year. But it was just a big moment for me in realizing that I wasn't going to stack up a bunch of wins on the tour.
Specifically, what did you change in your training and mindset to try to focus on winning tournaments?
The biggest thing was really Thursday morning. Like, if you're going to win, Tiger says all the time, like, it's a marathon. The majors are a marathon. They're not a sprint, and I'm just plugging along and this and that. The record says otherwise. Every time he's won a major, except for maybe the Masters in 19, he's led after one round and definitely after two. Like, I think it's like 14 out of 14 he's led on Friday night. And that was a big change for me. So, I prepared basically to like hit the gas, slam the gas pedal on Thursday morning, because you have to. You have to get to 20 under to win a golf tournament. And if you ease into it, you know, even on the front nine, one over, one under the first round, like, now you have to go shoot 20 under in 3 days. And it was a big mindset shift, and helped me a lot.
A lot of people in your situation, though, you know, I think would say, hey, or at least a lot of people here from the outside looking would say, well, yeah, maybe you can't win them all, but I mean, somebody's got to be 50th in the world. Somebody's got to be 40th in the world. And maybe you can't win, but especially on the heels of success, like what you mentioned there, getting to Eastlake, getting into the Masters, a lot of people say, well, okay, maybe I can't win all the what are now elevated events, or maybe I'm going to struggle in some of the majors because of how deep the field is, but I can make a living. I can be pretty good. Why at that point you're like, all right, well, I've shown I can do this. I'm going to be done.
No, I didn't stop playing then. I mean, that was 2016, yeah. And I play. I mean, 27.
But you were looking to get out. You said around that time.
It was just like a big, you know, like realization. It was just a real realization of what reality was, right? And no, I mean, 2017, I was in all the majors, and I didn't play well. I mean, I felt like my career, especially the second half, like I had to squeeze all the juice out of the lemon to play great. And it didn't leave a lot of energy left. And I had a really up and down career. And I think that's why I just took so much energy and input. I basically had to give my whole life to it to play at that level. And yeah, I mean, at no point am I saying that I was ranked like 100th in the world, or I was comfortably in the top 125 and I walked away from the tour. So, I mean, again, fast forward, played my last event in 2021. And at that point, in like 2019, I played pretty well the whole year. Like, again, nothing crazy, but I played pretty well. And I finished like 132 on the money list. And it happens quick. And that's what, there's only 125 good jobs. And when Sam Burns comes on the tour and Scottie Scheffler comes on the tour and Colin Morikawa comes on, like, I wasn't beating those guys. And they came and took my job. It's a zero-sum game in professional golf. So at that point, yes, could I have eked out? I think my easiest way to summarize it's the best job in the world when you feel like you can go do what you're capable of and be one of the 100 best players. It's a real, real punishing grind when you get below that level, right? Triple-A ball is not as much fun as playing for the Braves.
You mentioned you played pretty well and finished 130th-ish on the season-ending money list. For people out there that may not know just how good you were playing, what handicap index do you think you would have had finishing 130th?
Like plus 6 or 7. Yeah. Well, I started keeping a gin. I post every score I play now. I'm still a pro, but I have a gin. And I started it when I was not playing professionally every day anymore, but I was, and it was like a plus 6.4. So probably a little better than that when I was still on tour. There's no biggest misconception the general golfing public has about the tour is you flip on the golf channel on Thursday night and you're like, oh, somebody shot 8 under, somebody shot 7 under, like course is probably pretty playable, or somebody shot 9 under. The golf courses every single week on the tour are brutally difficult, brutally difficult. And someone is still shooting those numbers. Like what Scheffler, when he, I don't even know if he's played an over par round. I think he'd shot an even or something at the Masters. His first like 32 rounds this year were under par on the PGA Tour. That is impossible. His gin would be like a plus 11. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, it is. It's insane to think about how good those guys are. Because again, a lot of the scores that you're seeing too are based on normal setups, not even on the tour courses, based on normal setups, not tour setups, which are notoriously more difficult.
Yeah, so, it's crazy.
It's always good to provide that perspective, because I hear it from people. I think people don't realize, both even guys who are solid golfers don't realize what it takes to play at that next level, knowing the guys, and not just at that next level, but each level, how much harder it is. There's lots of people I've seen, frankly, get bad advice or come up with their own bad advice saying, I should go play pro. And for some guys, actually, I've never seen it work out for guys who didn't play college golf.
Yeah.
And weren't coming right out of that for the most part. But I see a lot of people think, oh, that guy's really good. And then he go get sponsored for something. And if you haven't played golf at a high level already, it's really hard to get to where you can play golf at a high level.
Yeah, if you're the four guy on a top 25 college team, you're the 150th best player in college, or the 100th best player. Those guys come out every year, so you're about the 5,000th best high level play. Like you go have to jump 4,750 people just to get on the Korn Ferry Tour, right? And when you it's a big gap from reality, for sure.
Absolutely. So speaking of being the 150th best player in college, tell us about your college time just in general at Georgia Tech and how you ended up there.
Yeah, I really, that was my dream. That was my goal when I started playing junior golf, was to play at Georgia Tech. I went to the NCAA championship at Opelika in 2000 or 99 or something. And I watched the final round. Tech lost in a playoff to Oklahoma State, but I don't know. I loved the team. I loved the golf bags, the blue and yellow. It was Cooch and Bryce Mulder and all those guys. And when I became a good junior player, I visited a couple places, but it was a no-brainer for me. So played at Tech, had a good career, was a four-time All-American, a little bit up and down, and did a lot of school. I mean, I finished in 4 years and studied engineering. So I think I was a pretty good college player, but I got a lot better when I turned pro because I was only playing golf.
What was the difference for you going from, we talk about going from levels, going from junior golf to college golf? I mean, that can be hard, but being an All-American for 4 years, again, especially when you're at a school where you're spending a lot of time playing school and playing golf. What was that transition like for you, and how did you manage to keep, not just to keep your game up, but improve your game?
My game was pretty similar, like junior golf and college golf. I didn't think there was that big of a transition. The big transition is really team golf, because in college you have a team and you might practice together and you spend all this time together, but at the end of the day, you go play by yourself and you post a score. So I think that can be challenging. You know, there's a perfect example. Let's say you have a bad putting day. Some players say, hey, I'm going to go get a milkshake and watch a movie. I'm going to get my mind off of it. I'm a great putter. Tomorrow, I'll probably make everything. And some guys want to go hit 100 three-footers. And when you're in a team, your coach may have an opinion, or he may lead you this way or lead you that way. And it's not really your routine. So that's just a dumb example. But learning to play team college golf was a little bit of an adjustment. But otherwise, I thought it was not too big of a jump.
No, I think Cooper and I are both sympathetic to that, especially with depending on where at school you went to, how the coach was like practice organization, et cetera, spending all your time doing 2 hours or spending 2 hours of organized team practice on things that you didn't need to work on, or were like, at least for me, I had way bigger problems whenever I was healthy than whatever we were working on. And so it can be a pain. And then once you're out doing your own thing, at least you can fix what you need to fix. And some programs run that way. Tennessee runs their program more so that way, from what we understand from Coach Webb, whereas other schools are a little bit more have a little bit more
structure,
a curriculum. Yeah, structure to them. What was your team like? What was the coaching like? And what was your perspective on the Tech program?
We never had any organized practice. So our coach was huge on qualifying. So the first tournament of every fall, if you made match play at the US Amateur, you got an exemption of that first tournament. But if you didn't, you were qualifying. So low five went to the first tournament in the fall, and low five went to the first tournament in the spring, no matter if you were a first team All-American the year before. And we would re-qualify a lot during the year. So he was just a big proponent. I mean, the number one asset a college team has is like 10 guys that are really good players. So make them go compete against each other, and they're going to get a lot better. So that was Hepler's attitude, and it was a good one. And it prepares you for professional golf, which is you have to go prove it every day, right? Q school, qualifying, Monday, like golf and life are one big qualifier. So I was a huge proponent of that and bought into it, and most of the guys did. You know, again, beyond that, I didn't learn how to hit wedges from coach, or I didn't learn how to chip or hit a 7-iron, but I learned a ton in college from him just about leadership, about life, about work ethic, his basic motto is like, if you're going to do something, do it really well. I wasn't that good of a student in high school, didn't study, didn't try, and did really well academically in college, basically just because coach was like, hey, if you're going to do something, do it right. Like everything we do here, we do it right. And I kind of bought into that, and you know, that was a big life lesson. That would be my biggest takeaway from college.
With your degree at Georgia Tech, how many hours do you think you were spending on school per week? How many hours do you think you were spending on golf per week? And then once you turned professional, how many hours did you spend on golf per week?
Yeah, when I was in school, you know, the school ebbs and flows. I don't know. You go to class, which is whatever, 12 hours, which is nothing. And then maybe another 12 to 24 hours a week studying, more towards the end of semesters. And then you get some labs, which like kill a day in the, like your whole afternoon, you can't play golf. My senior year though, I had to do senior design, which is basically like a 50 hour a week job in addition to class and golf. We worked with the Georgia Aquarium, and I didn't practice for an entire semester. So like my senior year, I think I was second or third team All-American. I just finished like 25th, 25th, 25th in all the fall tournaments, and then played really well in the spring, because I was done with that and mostly done with my classes. But so, you know, it probably cost me like being a first team All-American my senior year if I would have played both semesters, but I didn't practice one time in the fall of my senior year. And then when I turned pro, it was full-time job. I mean, I played as many tournaments as I could. I mean, a day at the golf course was, you know, either play 18 holes and practice a little bit, or practice for, you know, 4 or 5 hours and drive and practice rounds and qualifiers and mini tour events. So it was a lot. We can get to that, but that's a big jump from level to level.
Yeah. Tell us about that jump. And also, you know, when you went pro, you didn't have status immediately. There was no PGA Tour U. There wasn't the road there was a little bit different than what it is now, both for better and worse for you. Tell us about your road.
Mostly worse. I thought I would get through Q school. I really did. I was a good player. I was always a good qualifier. And I went through first stage and got through, went to second stage. Yeah, and I missed at second stage. And at the time, the sports psych that I was working with said that Q school and golf, but I think he specifically, I remember this around Q school, is like taking a balloon that has a hole in it, even if it has a tiny pinhole in it, and you put it underwater, you can see where the air comes out, right? Like no matter what. And I definitely realized that at that first Q school. And the guys I played with, like I played the final round of second stage with a guy, Tim Wilkinson from New Zealand, who played on tour for 5 or 10 years. And like when I fell apart under the pressure of, you know, that last round, like he was just striping it. And he just, you could tell with his demeanor and like the shots he could hit that his balloon didn't really have any holes in it at that time. And from there, so, you know, I kind of had to regroup. That being said, though, the tour was so different. Like the expectation of guys coming out of college, even the best players were not necessarily expected to get straight onto the tour. Like my year, JB Holmes did it and Dustin did it, DJ. And then like the Chris Kirks and Brendan Todds and me and Kiz, and we didn't make it through Q school. And it was kind of like, yeah, you play mini tours like a year or two or a Korn Ferry free. And it wasn't that big of a deal. It was almost like you had to work your way up. And that's just so different now, right? These guys get so good. I mean, they're established on tour at, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old. PGA Tour U helps, but it's mostly just how good they are. So a little bit different in that regard.
What was the mini tour phase life like? I know you played on the eGolf Tour, I think, for 3 years, had some wins there, and then got some status on Nationwide, and then got to the PGA Tour.
It was great. I was super lucky in the just timing of it. I think the first like 9 months after Q school, or first 6 months, I kind of felt sorry for myself. Like, I mean, to be totally honest, like I was going to some shitty Hooters tour event in some awful town, you know, small town somewhere. And like, I had this, like, I played at Georgia Tech and I'm better than this attitude. And that might've been like just 4 or 6 months, but I remember the first half of that next year, like I missed a few cuts on mini tour events and I was way better than I didn't need to, but I don't remember exactly when, but I kind of snapped out of it and realized that I had a huge opportunity. And at that time, Hooters Tour was really a good tour. I mean, 156 player fields, good players, 4 rounds. You really learned how to play professional golf out there. So I signed up for that tour. I signed up for eGolf, which was in Charlotte. Those were 3 days. You'd ride in carts, but still a bunch of good players. And again, you could play 25, 28 tournaments if you combine those two tours. And I didn't play a ton of junior golf. College golf, you only play 8 or 10 tournaments or 10 or 12. And then in the summer, I didn't play a full summer schedule either. So I really needed to get, like, if I played mini tours for 3 years or whatever it was, I needed to get like 90 tournaments in, like get those reps in. So it was awesome. And there was actually money out there too. You know, I mean, the eGolf had this random year where they had 3 or 4 tournaments that were, the winner got 50 grand. And I think I won 2 of them and Kiz won 2 of them. And I mean, he still jokes that he was like, that's the richest I've ever been. Like I had my little house and my Tahoe and I was making, you know, we both made like 200 grand. We're like a year or two out of school, like, I mean, no expenses. And he's like, now I'm making millions of dollars, but like I got a family and I'm spending millions of dollars too. So I kind of can sympathize with that. And, but yeah, I had 2 credit cards, and one was for golf stuff so I could do my expenses, and one was for personal. And I swear to you, the summer I got on the Korn Ferry Tour, I Monday qualified in and played like 4 tournaments in a row. My balance on my personal card was $0. Like I had an apartment and just didn't have cable, like would just use the internet, whatever. I mean, $0 in personal expenses for a month. So, I mean, it's just a different life, right?
That is nice. When you got on the Nationwide / Korn Ferry now, what was it like? Again, as we said, every level is different and you got a little bit of tournament experience on your belt. What was it like getting there? And then, you know, you performed at a high level that year and got yourself status through the Nationwide.
Yeah, that was an easy adjustment because I probably had been on the mini tours like 1 year too long. The year before, I had won like 3 or 4 events on the mini tour. I didn't miss a single cut. Like I was definitely one of the best players at that level. And I went to Q school and shot 73, 73, 73, 73 in first stage. I mean, I hadn't shot like in the 70s the whole summer and bombed out of first stage. So that was obviously a bummer. But the next summer, I Monday qualified and finished second in a nationwide tour event and was kind of off to the races. So I felt pretty comfortable. Again, I had learned to play pro golf. I had learned what playing 28 events a year was like. I'd kind of done all that and was able to get my card in like a year on the nationwide tour. But it's, so the year I came back to the nationwide tour, fast forward like whatever, 8 or 9 years, my brother caddied for me and he had, he'd played in college and he'd played pro golf for like a year or two, Cooper, probably similar to your story. And he had hung it up and he was kind of doing a couple things. We were doing the Castro Golf Consulting together, but I said, hey, come caddy for me for 6 months if you want to. And I had like two babies at home and was playing like half the schedule because I just had a lot going on. But at one point we played like 3 out of 4 weeks and I was going into the tournaments like Tuesday night. And then I would just play the practice round, or like the pro-am is my practice round. So we were like kind of playing part-time. And after those 3 out of 4, we were driving home from Mississippi and I'll never forget it. And he turns to me and he goes, man, I could have never done this. It's way too much golf. And that is a realization a lot of people have. I mean, and again, that was some of those years on tour, I was playing 31 events. The mini tour, I was playing 28 events. Like, it's a lot of golf and travel. And I loved every minute of it. But I think having that realization for him was pretty, you know, pretty profound.
I had a similar experience. One of Daniel and I's best friends, Ashton Van Horn, played the last couple of years on the Korn Ferry Tour. And kind of right when I was thinking about not playing anymore, I went out and caddied for him 3 weeks in a row. And yeah, it really wasn't until I actually caddied for him, saw what it was like week to week, that I finally made my decision. Because I was like, wait, this is what it's like. it's different when when you're doing it day in and day out.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the first tournament my father-in-law came to was Memorial. My wife's from Cincinnati. So he came over to Columbus and I can't remember if he watched all four rounds or whatever. And so, you know, classic like 10 a.m. tee time on Sunday. So we book a 4:30 flight to Colonial or wherever the hell we were going next and finish, sign the card. Bags are in the courtesy car. Like my wife and I hop in, like give him a hug. And he looked at us and he was like, I am exhausted. Y'all are going to do this again next week? And it's like, yeah, you straight to the airport to the next one and maybe take it easy on Monday and then pick it back up, right? It's a 6 day a week. And I loved every minute of it. I was made for it. Like I could do it. I loved it. I loved all of it. My favorite moment of professional golf was Sunday night. Like Sunday night it was all upside because it was a new week. You know, it was just like every week felt like you could win the tournament or play better, or you had some thought on the putter or this swing thought. So I thrived off of it.
What was it like now at this point in time, you get a little bit more established on tour, you have a wife, you have kids, and having to manage your schedule, manage your tournaments. And as you said earlier, like if you wanted to be good, you had to give it everything you have, and giving all your time, et cetera, to that is not always the easiest way to keep your marriage / kids happy and together.
Yeah, no, it's, pro golf is not for the faint of heart. Pro sports, honestly. Like I have some friends that played professional baseball and that's as bad or worse. You know, it's tough. I had some good, some good stretches after we started having kids and had a family. But it was, like I said, I was having to squeeze every last bit of juice out of the orange, and it didn't leave a lot of myself for home stuff. And, it's just the travel. Yeah. It's tough. There's no way around it. And it's all the respect in the world to the guys that do it and do it well and make it look easy. And some of them do. I mean, it's very impressive. A lot of my friends, close friends I've had since I was 13, 14, the Chris Kirks, Brendan Todds, all those guys, like they have great families and they're playing some of the best golf of their career. So all the credit to them for, figuring out how to compartmentalize and make it work. It's a tall task.
Do you remember a certain instance where you realized, uh-oh, I need to make a decision here?
No, like I said, COVID hit. So like that was probably when I started doing more of the Castro Golf consulting and figuring out what options there were in the world for somebody like me. But I played like 16 events on tour. I was conditional plus COVID. So from COVID through like the next 14 months, I played like 16 events. So really like 16 events in those like 8 or 10 months after the tour picked back up. But I remember a college, another Georgia Tech golf guy, he said that somebody told him when he turned pro that when you hit the last putt, you'll know it's the last putt. And when I hit my last putt, I knew, like I 1000% knew that that was going to be my last putt on tour. And it was.
We've talked a lot about your career, talked some about your work now. I want to talk a little bit about what we like to talk about, which is the tournaments. We've talked about how you've progressed, but what was your preparation like week to week? And you mentioned Sunday was one of your favorites that evening because of the possibilities of the next week, a new swing thought, a new putting thought, a new putter. What sort of work were you doing swing wise week to week, period to period? You know, you have a month off, who are you working with, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. The, one of the biggest contributors to me ever playing on PGA Tour was that when I turned pro, I had a coach, Jeff Patton, who I spent a ton of time with. I'd worked with him through college, but again, like we talked about, I was doing school, I was playing, but he just invested so much time in me and I had all this time. So I would play as many mini tour events as I could, Monday qualifiers. But when I was home, I'd go to Golf Club of Georgia and we would spend 2-3 hours together, 2-3 times a week. And that was huge for me. I mean, I'm a huge believer in coaching. So I was spending all day out there, you know, working on my game with someone that I trusted. And then even kind of second half of my career, I was working with John Tillery. And the best year I had that year we talked about where I, you know, almost won Quail and almost won BMW. It's funny, the year before I was conditional and I played like 15, 16 events. And that year I was conditional, I was working with Tillery. And like every 2 weeks I was driving to the lake and we would spend like half a day together. And I only played 15 tournaments because that's all I could get in. But I really improved and like tightened up my game that year. And I feel like it set me up for that success in 2016. And then once you get out there and you start running, you lose some of that time at home. And then the next year you're not playing well. So you I've missed a couple cuts in a row. I'm going to add an event. So instead of going home to work with JT, I'm going to play one more event. And it's like a wheel that doesn't turn in the right direction. So those two coaches played a big part, especially Jeff. It was just an incredible opportunity for me. And I'm still so thankful for all that time that he invested in me.
That brings up something interesting that we've talked about with other guys, which is tournament scheduling, et cetera. If you were going to go back and redo it, would you pick your tournament schedule, stick with it, and then use those off weeks for instruction? Or would you put the pedal to the metal essentially and keep pushing through and do what you did?
No, I'd go back and change it. I mean, I really would. Both the years that I followed up good years with bad years, I just started chasing it. And it felt, if I had to do it over again, I would have taken like the last 2 weeks of May and gone to the beach for 2 weeks, left my clubs at home, come home and practice for a week, and then gone back out to have a big June, July, August. But that's not what most people do. And I wasn't smart enough to figure it out.
Can you have fun when playing golf now? I think that's something Cooper and I talked about. I never had fun. Once I started playing competitively, I never had fun playing golf until I stopped playing competitively. And Cooper was the same way. Like, you go out and play golf, but it was never, I mean, there's like competitiveness, but it wasn't really like, oh, I'm going to have fun while playing golf.
So now y'all enjoy it or you don't?
No, I do. I love it. I mean, yeah. I could see not enjoying it at the end of the road, then maybe I was planning to go down, and I see that with other people. I also say, like, I'm glad I quit pro.
But when you're playing competitively, Cooper, like if you and I would go out and play, it wasn't fun for you. It wasn't fun for you. And right. especially like for some of our buddies who were competitive, like I was not playing well and they'd be annoyed. I'm like, look, man, I'm just out here having fun. This is, yeah, this like is when fun Daniel
was, when Daniel was in law school, if he came up, it was definitely hard to go out and just enjoy a round of golf. But now it's like, it's completely different, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I never played for fun when I was playing pro golf. I enjoyed all the golf, but I was only playing for one reason, which was to shoot a low score, figure out how to shoot lower scores. Maybe like once a year, a friend gets married and like the Friday before golf, like you're really just having a good time and having a couple Bloody Marys or whatever. Now I have fun playing every time I play. I really do. I still try to shoot a score. Like there's a million reasons why people play golf. I've talked about this on our pod. I play to shoot a score. And that's, I want to shoot a score. I mean, unless I'm really playing in like, yeah, charity scramble, like, of course, I don't care. But otherwise, I try to shoot something, but I do have fun.
Yeah, I will say that's one thing I don't understand is people that say they're not trying to shoot a score when they play and just simply have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, look, some people play to gamble and that's not shooting a score. Right. Yeah. Some people play to, I mean, they want to exercise. Like that's a real thing. They just want to walk and hit extra shots for sure. You know, I'm not like that.
That's why I hit so many extra shots compared to Cooper's, because I want that extra exercise of swinging. I like taking 80 shots to get the ball in the hole during a round as opposed to 68. Yeah. It's more fun. That extra 12.
Yeah.
Switching gears here, talking about time off the course. This, when you were playing professional golf, I think it was, as you said, guys came in, they were better coming out of college. They're also, I think we're seeing this more and more, I would argue, more athletic guys. Golf is getting less of the guys that couldn't do anything else and more of the guys that could do a lot of other things. And it's not like a wholesale change, but more guys that could do other things that are more athletic and are not just are more athletic, but are focusing on it more. And it's not just the top of the top that's that, it's that way more so throughout the field. What were you doing off the course, fitness wise, anything in that front?
Yeah. I mean, the only, you know, one of the few regrets I have about my career, and it seems crazy now that I didn't, was I didn't do like any speed training. I mean, I could see that the tour was getting longer and that it was a huge, you know, almost a required skill. And that, you know, I mean, I knew the stat or whatever, every 10 yards is like 0.2 shots or something. But I just came from a generation where like guys that chased speed usually like lost their games. Right. I mean, and some of this, like the speed sticks, and Phil was doing the thing with the heavy driver and the light driver, but there wasn't like these training systems, like the stack and the bands and the things that, like, again, now I'm like, it's crazy because I haven't done it, but I know I have like a couple friends that like, yeah, I do the bands speed training and I've picked up like 6 miles an hour. Like that would have been huge for me and I just didn't do it. So, I mean, I was lucky. I didn't have a lot of injuries, did enough in the gym. But if I had to go back and do it again, I would have practiced less, tried to be stronger and done a lot of that speed training.
What was your club head speed / ball speed?
I was like 165, 166 on ball speed. So when I got on tour, I was like 90th or 100th in distance. And when I left the tour, I was 205th out of 205.
What do you think JB Holmes and DJ were when they first came out?
190. But they were, it was just a completely different generation. Like everyone knew that the best player in the world had always driven it long and maybe longest, Norman, Nicholas, Tiger. But nobody in college, like, we didn't sit around and focus on like the guys that hit it long, right? Like Chris Kirk was kind of one of the best players. Webb Simpson was one of the best players in my generation. I was a good player. Kiz was a good player. I'm probably missing a bunch. And we weren't that long. It wasn't that big of a deal. And it's no coincidence that JB and DJ got on tour immediately and had a ton of success. Like the pro game is very different than the college game. In the tour game, the biggest gap in golf between levels is between the Korn Ferry and the PGA Tour. So that and distance is a big part of that.
Yeah. And you also guys at that time, I mean, really when you start to see the transition of people focusing on speed, the tools for measuring that weren't there. Strokes gained had not been discovered or invented, however you want to define that, had not been really invented/discovered, and then hadn't even become popularized probably till 2013, 2014, when we're starting to see, oh, we can actually tell you exactly what you said. Oh, I hit it. I added a mile per hour. I gained 0.2 strokes, all else being equal.
Yeah, to this day, I'm not that big of a fan of strokes gained. This may be a whole nother episode. I'm a numbers guy, an engineering guy, but I'd love y'all's perspective.
You got 5 minutes before I know you got to hop off, so give us your case.
We may need to extend.
We got time.
I think, simply put, if you want to have a long, successful career on the PGA Tour, I'm not talking about winning majors. I'm not talking about like being number one in the world. There are two skills you need. You should either be a prodigious driver or a prodigious putter. Like the best driver you've ever seen or the best putter you've ever seen. Those two skills in my life, like those guys are still on the tour and they make money and they don't stress that much and they keep their card. And it just goes against what, you know, Brandel's yapping about every week about how it's all about the iron game. It's all about the iron game. It's all about proximity. And I don't believe it. I mean, I made it on tour because of my iron game and my chipping, and it was a grind. It was a ton. I mean, the guys that do it like Harmon and do it like Kiz that are good at every single part of the game is so much more difficult than being a prodigious driver or being an incredible putter. So, you know, the stats don't square that, but I've played 198 events, and that's my opinion.
Who would be somebody that's doing really well on tour because they're a prodigious putter?
So Russell Henley, Chris Kirk, you saw it with Snedeker, Denny McCarthy. Denny is a perfect example. Like, he's good at a lot of the parts of the game, but he's unbelievable putter, like unbelievable. And that is it's a cheat code. It really is. It's an absolute cheat code. And I'm sure I'm missing a bunch. Brendan Todd. I mean, guys, you know, that have had long, I mean, Kuchar, Stuart Sink, you know, Stuart's 6'5" and whatever and hits it long and is good at every part of the game. But he led the tour in putting with the short putter and the belly putter at different points of his career. Prodigious putter. So that, and driving's no different. I mean, this Chris Goddard that won this week at Myrtle Beach, I know him through my brother. And like, I was checking in yesterday and it had gotten like a little close. He eagles a par 5. I check again on the back. He's up by like 5 and he gets to a par 5. 345 right fairway, 190 to a par 5. So he's hitting driver 8-iron in the middle of the green on a par 5. And when I say like being a great driver, I'm talking like not the kid on your college team who like hits it long and on the home course drives it straight. Like, I'm talking about like the wind's in and off the left and there's water down the left and you're aiming it on that water and still striping at 310. Like, I'm talking about under pressure, tough tee shots, like PGA Tour level stuff, still being a great driver. Not like the sixth guy on the team who just bombs it on the driving range with the TrackMan.
Which one of those do you think is more trainable? So let's accept your premise at face value. Go ahead, Coop.
I was also going to say, like, doesn't strokes gain back up that being a prodigious driver is the most important thing?
I think it might. Yeah.
I mean,
again, I just, the strokes gained to me, I mean, I'm sure it washes out over a season. Like, of course, Scotty's like leading every feat, like, but I haven't gained any incredible insights from strokes gained. And in short bursts, like, I played with Russell Henley at Houston the year he won the first two rounds, and he was like +6 strokes gained putting. Bullshit. He made like a dozen 25 footers. Like, he gained a million strokes on the greens. And then I was a guy who would miss. I was a good ball striker and I would miss some cuts because I would go 34 putts, 34 putts.
I would
look at it and I would be like -2 putting. And it was like, no, I left 12 strokes on the greens. Like, I'm not exaggerating. And it would be like -2 strokes gained. And again, over the season, it probably is a great metric. But
I will say I think there are some issues with accuracy on Stokes game, because we're friends with Josh Teeter and his caddy. And like a couple weeks ago, it said he lost, like, it was the first round, he shot like 73 or something, and it said he lost like 2 strokes putting. And I texted Joe, his caddy, I said, you just couldn't make anything today? He's like, no, we putted fine. You know, he hit it everywhere. And I'm like, well, I think he would have told me he putted bad if he actually lost 2 strokes putting. So I don't know.
It definitely leaves something to be desired. I think that's the issue. And I know we're coming up on time, so I'll lead us to wrap in a second. But it leaves some areas to be desired, I think. And this might be good for another conversation another time. But at the same time, it's the closest thing we have. It's the best thing we have to measure, to be able to compare shots. Because the best way to compare, at least data in general, the best way to compare individual thing or compare things is the individual level. But the problem is when you have, there's so many individual things to compare, you have to have some sort of category or lumping mechanism to be able to compare them to, so you can help make determinations as to general rules. I know that's very broad, but essentially you have to have some sort of sorting mechanism when you're looking at any type of data in order to be able to compare it and to be able to get broad trends, because you know there have to be broad trends that exist. And at least to me, that's the closest thing we have. What you're saying is generally true. While maybe the top guys, the top 50 or so, or the top 10 have the best strokes gained driving, et cetera, when you look at the strokes gained putting, I would want to see this without like thinking about it too hard. When you look at strokes gained putting, a lot of those guys, you're like, well, that guy's not that good, but he's had a pretty good shelf life. I mean, this not that good. He's not like leading the world, but a lot of those guys have a pretty good shelf life. Greg Chalmers has had a pretty good shelf life for being a guy that doesn't hit it that far or anything of that nature.
Yeah, I'd probably go up a level from that. Like, Ryan Palmer has had an unbelievable career. He's an incredible driver. Unbelievable driver. I mean, he just hits these bomb draws that when he has a good driving week, golf's not that hard from 140 yards out in the middle of the fairway. And now these guys like Scheffler and Brooks, no course is hard when you hit it 325 and straight. Like, even a 500-yard hole, you're hitting an 8-iron in from the middle of the fairway. So, yeah, I mean, Rotella told me one time, he was like, look, the stats are great for the fans. The tour, like, invented them in the mid-80s so they could give the fans more to talk about. And now with all the advanced metrics and strokes gained and whatnot, like, it's great for the fried egg and it's great for this conversation here. But from a player standpoint, I don't think they don't add a lot of value to the players. And I think they can actually detract. I mean, I'm familiar with the decade and this and that. And it's like, Rotella has coached 50 major champions. And he tells you, if you have a 7-iron or shorter, hit it right at the damn flag. And if it's longer than a 7-iron, hit it in the middle of the green. And honestly, you just don't get that much more information from all these modern like stat platforms. And again, this is my opinion. I know it's probably unpopular and plenty of people will throw tomatoes at me. But from a player standpoint, it's not as complicated as people think. It's not. And the next episode, it's about toughness. It's about toughness and 99% toughness, and the rest of it is not that complicated.
It would be easy for me to just say, like, you know, that's dumb. I don't think that that's true, because I've obviously – stats have helped me a lot, and that's what I've grown up with playing competitive golf. But genuinely curious, like, how would you evaluate a round when you were out on tour in college – without any of the stuff that everybody's used to now?
Well, it's funny. Like, you have to know what your success metrics are. I was a very average putter. I mean, you know, I'd have my moments. If I had something that started with a 2, 20-something putts, I would shoot in the 60s. It was that simple. I mean, it was that simple. And, Rotella would track your fairways, track your greens, track your putts. And, like, I get it. You chip it up there to a foot, you make a 1-footer, it's a 1-putt. But you know what? Chipping and putting are short game. Like, that's how you get it in the hole. The goal is not to chip it to 10 feet and then gain a third of a shot by making a 10-footer. It's the goal is to chip it to a foot. And that's why these guys with incredible short games like maybe aren't as high up in the putting because they chip it like this every time. So those were my metrics. I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy for me. Again, you chip it to a foot, you miss one, you three putt. But when I would finish my round, you could almost to a tee say 30 putts, I'd shoot 70. 26 putts, 66. It was almost perfect every single time.
We'll have to pick this up sometime because I think we could do a whole one on this. We got to let you go. The last question we ask every guest is the same, which is if you go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be?
I would say just to think long term. It's going to be a long road. If you want to do this, you're going to have a lifelong relationship with golf, and that may be in the professional sense. It may be recreational, maybe with your kids one day, your grandkids, but it's a game for a lifetime, and it's, you know, it's a blessing and an opportunity to get to play. So just think big picture. You should do like a round table with like four or five people, because I want to know like the guys that are on tour and the great coaches and the good players, like what are they looking at? What am I missing? Would they agree with me? Would they tell me I'm dumb, especially on the stats thing, the targets and the decade stuff? Like I obviously have a lot to learn. I'd just be curious other people's thoughts.
I don't think that the targets is that really big of a contention point, but I think that the looking at stats, I think that there would be a lot of pushback on that.
Okay.
But I don't think like firing at the pin with anything lower than 7 iron, like that's generally fine for most good players in most circumstances. And, you know, but I think that
one's hard because, again, what depends on what you're measuring by and how you can determine success there. Because you're talking like the point of like if you follow that general rule, the 7 iron rule, you're probably going to be. And again, let's accept in this case the strokes gained is a good metric, okay? Because that's the only way we can that's the only way we can measure it, right? Otherwise, right? I'm assuming that's about the only way you could measure it.
Well, no, the stats stuff is great, like the proximity. Yeah. On tour, your shot length breaks out. Like, you know, I do agree, Cooper. Like, you should look at the end of the year, like 150 to 175, you were terrible. Like, and that's just a simple number. It's like you average 45 feet and the average on tour is 40 and Scottie Scheffler's 30. Like, I don't need a strokes gain number. Your caddy should be like, dude, you suck at hitting wedges. Like,
but procs matters if you have tucked pins, because if I like, I guess that's what would be my contention. Proximity, like, only measures that proximity. And so if I, again, I know that I maybe we fundamentally disagree on cone of dispersion, et cetera. But if I center my shot pattern around the pin and the pin's in the corner, I might hit a lot close. I might also hit some in the water, and the hitting in the water is what's going to hurt me. Like, you think about,
because you could be 15 feet from the pin and yes, it's in the water.
You could hit a good shot and be 15 feet from the pin. And that's where I think that the target stuff matters, is you're not like necessarily gaining with each individual shot. You're not, again, we have to assume strokes gained is good. And that's, I think, maybe the kind of cheer. We have to assume that that is at least a solid measure, but it's not like you're gaining a shot each time you make a good target, because it's impossible to, but you're gaining a 0.05, you're gaining a 0.1 maybe, and then over, okay, maybe probably 0.05.
Why do I need any of all that stuff you might say is fine? You know, the best player who ever lived is Tiger. He hit the most greens in regulation. Jack's the second best. And who's the best player today? The guy, number one GIR, Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah.
You don't, as a player, not as a podcaster or as a commentator or a writer, as a player, you don't need to know more than hit as many greens in regulation as you can, hit your wedges close, and get it up and down. Like, Scotty is just hitting all the greens in regulation. You can't beat a guy who doesn't miss greens, and then he chips at gimme every time he – it's not that complicated.
I agree you don't – you're not going to – I agree as to – and someone agrees like, regularly. But if you aim at the pin every single time and you have corner pins, your green regulations is going to be lower. It's not an individual function of just how good a ball striker is. But that's not
the right
way to
play, obviously, because the guy hitting all the greens is the one winning all the tournaments.
Exactly. That's not the right way to play, to hit at the pin every – Cooper's losing my – of course, that's not the right way to play.
I do have to go to work.
Okay. Last thing. Right. Guys who are really good know, like guys like Tiger, guys like Jack, some of those guys, they don't have to have the decade because, or whatever it is, whatever system, they don't have to have that because they know intuitively, like that's part of what's good. They have a feel for that. And then the guys who suck like me or Cooper might not have a feel of where to aim. And that's where those systems are.
I'm not bringing my decade book out there on the course and looking at it before every shot, but it helped me to go to that seminar when I was a junior golfer.
I'm sure that's a great point. Okay. People are learning to play the game. That's a great point. You don't want to, if you can shorten the learning curve, right? And you don't have to hit 50 balls in the water your whole junior career. Cause you like, absolutely. I'm not against these things. I'm talking about what I know best, which is how to be a top 100 player in the world, how to be a top 50 player in the world. Like I struggle talking to junior golfers. I actually met with the U.S. national team on Friday and was like on a little panel. And I really try to think about what I was thinking about when I was 14, 15 years old. It's just so long ago. And it's such a different deal that I'm not of a great value add. Like if you're like a guy on the mini tours or Korn Ferry, like I can help you with my information, but I'm not as helpful for a junior player, right? Cause a junior guy, he's trying to make his varsity team or he's trying to qualify for an AJGA. And that's all awesome. We've all been there, but I'm not a good coach for that person. So
absolutely. Where can people find you on social media, find your podcast, all that fun stuff?
Yeah, at Castro Golf on Instagram. Podcast is Course Record Show. We're on Apple, Spotify, all that. So Course Record Show. And then I'm on Twitter also, so you can find me on Twitter.
And you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code, on Twitter / X The Tournament Code, as always on YouTube, Spotify, and at podcast, wherever you get your podcast, make sure to subscribe, like, leave a rating. And then you know where to find our Supercast, ttc.supercast.com. As always, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. I look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.